calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And happy Tuesday to you. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on satellite, Sirius Satellite Radio, on radiopower.org, Live 365, American FM, and WhiteRoseSociety.org. WhiteRoseSociety.org also podcasting the program, also over on iTunes. So you can check it out there at WhiteRoseSociety.org or radiopower.org, also our live broadcast. Welcome back to our program. It is a lot going on today. John Bolton, of course, was put in yesterday, or put on, shall we say, the people of the world, embarrassment to the United States. This morning, George W. Bush signed CAFTA, or the Take This Job and Shove It bill, and speaking to the American people, and soon he'll be heading off to the ranch. So, you know, when Bush talks about, for example, Treasongate, the Karl Rove scandal, he talks about this large administration, a lot of senior officials, and, you know, it just seems like a good idea every now and then. In fact, let's just hear George, you know, lest we forget. I mean, it's important, I think, that we remember these things. George's comments.
And I don't know if we're going to find out the senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
So, speaking of senior officials, let's go
now behind enemy lines.
Behind enemy lines, and talk with one of the senior officials writing the conservative talking points, Evan Sayet. Evan.
Hey, Tom, but I got to stop you right there. I got a memo from Karl Rove this morning.
Okay.
And he said writing the conservative talking point is actually a registered trademark of his.
Oh, you're kidding.
So,
I guess we're in deep trouble. Yeah. He'll just have to out us in the Chicago Sun-Times, was it?
or else in Who's Who in America.
There you go. That's it. Evan Sayet, who writes for a number of conservative websites, and you have a website of your own or a blog, Evan?
I do. I have both. So let's send them to my website, though, because it links to my blog, and it's just easy to remember. It's Evan Sayet, SAYET.com.
Okay, evansayet.com. And you are going to be doing a fundraiser at the Friars Club?
I am. It's actually now, once again, legally, and I made the mistake because I told you it's the Friars Club, but we have to call it the Friars of Beverly Hills, California. And it's a night of conservative comedians. So
that sounds painful.
Yeah, that's you know, it's going to be another one of those mythbusters that that actually conservatives can laugh, and it's rated, you know, it's not a church gathering. It's certainly a bunch of South Park conservatives. But the idea is that we actually have punchlines that don't end with Bush is Hitler.
Ah, okay. Yeah. They end up with what, Clinton is Hitler?
I'm sorry? Clinton wasn't Hitler.
They end up with what? Clinton was fill in the blank, Evan.
You know what? We don't even make fun of Hitler. What I really talk about is how unfair it is to my kid that he's constantly being taught that if you're a queer guy, you're going to grow up to have a great eye. And if you're a beautiful, sexy, vivacious, heterosexual married woman, you're going to be a desperate housewife.
Interesting. Interesting. So you find
it's more of a cultural than a personal. Partly, yeah. Because who do you pick on amongst the Democrats? Who do they have?
Well, there's no shortage. But let's talk about John Bolton for a minute.
Sure.
You know, without taking the bait on either of those right now. John Bolton's nomination. Here's a guy who has made a career out of being obnoxious. I mean, this is the equivalent of walking into Macy's and saying to the clerk there, I need a new suit. I want to make sure I look good in it. Slap, slap, slap. You know, slap him upside the face a couple of times. Now, get it for me right now. And then say, yeah, does this look good enough on me? You know, I want to make sure that this is all about me, about my, you know, how I look. John Bolton, for example, is saying,
the United States makes the UN work when it wants it to work. And that is exactly the way it should be, because the only question for the United States is what's in our national interest. And if you don't like that, I'm sorry, but that is the fact.
Yeah, and now an Irish diplomat responded to that.
I don't believe for a single second that most of the good Americans who worked to get the seat on American soil would accept some of the arguments that we have just heard. In fact, I think some of them would be turning in their graves, as we say in Ireland, by what we have been listening to.
Now,
absolutely. Some of them would be turning in their graves. The problem is this. The argument can always be made some of anything. The reality is the American people do recognize that the United Nations is a collection of corrupt, child-raping, food-stealing, genocidal governments, and that the time has come for us to say, hey, you have a purpose. And we can live up to our higher ideals. And if it takes somebody whose tone of voice you don't like to talk to the genocidal murderers of the Sudan, I have no problem.
Evan, again, diplomacy is, first of all, let me say, we all agree that the interests of the United States should come first. I mean, everybody agrees on that. And there's a long history of people who agree on that. I mean, this absolutely. And by the way, let me just toss this out. If any of our listeners want to call in and get in on this conversation, you're welcome to our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. I know Evan enjoys taking your calls. But it is, the United Nations grew out of the League of Nations, and the League of Nations grew out of the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo back in 19 whatever it was, and in the early teens, with mm-hmm. led to World War One. Mm-hmm. And what had happened was there was this guy who gets shot, and it should be just a local event, but because this country had an agreement with that country that if it's attacked, it'll go to war with them, and then this country says, okay, well, if they attack, and there were all these interlocking security agreements all over Europe, and it turned into these dominoes just spread across Europe, because there was no place, regardless of whether people were genocidal maniacs or not, there was no place where people could sit down and talk about what's going on and have and decide, you know, here are the parameters under which it's appropriate for a nation to stop another nation from being genocidal, for example,
right,
versus when it's not.
That's, you know, and by the way, congratulations, that was a terrific and factual and accurate explanation of how that all came to be. And it's right, it's necessary, and it would be terrific if it worked. But the problem is that, and Democrats refuse to do this. They think that because an idea is good, it doesn't matter how utterly failed and corrupt and evil the actual practice. Yes, the United Nations is terrific on paper, but in reality, it is an evil.
So on the one hand, you would say, for example, that the fact that there haven't been any major attacks in the United States since 9/11 is proof that the Bush doctrine is working. You would not say that the fact that after 40 years of staring each other down with some of the worst weapons that man had ever created, that the human race has ever come up with, the Soviet Union and the United States didn't have a nuclear war, and that's not a success of the United Nations?
No, that's not a success of the United Nations at all. It was a success of mutually assured destruction. It was the reality that we were strong, and it was very clear to them that if they attacked us, they would be destroyed. And it was 100% mutually assured destruction. It had nothing to do with the United Nations. In fact, all these proxy wars that took place, it took place because there was no threat of mutually assured destruction. So they just became wars in Vietnam. They became wars that were started against Israel, and we protected Israel, and they protected the Syrians, and et cetera, et cetera. No, it was mutually assured destruction.
But this is all the more reason for there to be a United Nations. I mean, are you suggesting that there shouldn't be a United Nations?
No, I'm saying there should be a United Nations. But I have no problem with somebody going to the United Nations and saying, folks, you know, we're not here to make you feel good about being the genocidal guy from the Sudan, and I'm going to smile and in your face. I have no problem with that.
So the situation that John Bolton got us into with North Korea, for example, when he was supposed to be negotiating with North Korea, and he went over there and he calls Kim Jong-il a pygmy and calls him names, and so Kim Jong-il starts calling him names, and then he says, we're not going to talk to you anymore. And then after that, Kim Jong-il starts building nuclear weapons, takes down the cameras, and that's the kind of diplomacy that you think we should have. The Bush administration
and
John Bolton have
really
brought us nukes
that's
in
really
North Korea.
That's really how you see the history of North Korea. It's not that the Democrats went and once again said to the bad guys, hey, here's everything that you want in the negotiations. Just promise me you'll fulfill your part of it.
No, we didn't say promise. We said promise and verify. We had cameras in there. We were watching what was going on. When George Bush took office, North Korea was building nothing. Nothing.
That's just not true.
It was absolutely static, and we had cameras in there that we were monitoring from our side of the Pacific Ocean all the time.
We
and after John Bolton went in and started insulting these guys, they took down the cameras.
That's why they did it. So what you're telling me basically is that Kim Jong Il is a grown man who loves his people, but when his feelings were hurt, he decided to bomb the world.
I'm saying that it's even more important. I'm saying, Evan, when it's even more important when you're dealing with somebody who's irrational that you be rational. I'm saying that it's even more important when you're dealing with people who are as dangerous and as crazy as Kim Jong Il that you have more than one trick in your bag of tricks. And the only trick that John Bolton has is to yell at people and get mad at them.
But that's just not true. I mean, the reality is that...
Come on, he screwed up the biochemical weapons treaty. The 1973 treaty. In 2001, we were having negotiations to put teeth back into it so that the United Nations could go into the United States could initiate it, could go into third-party countries and say, do you have biological weapons? Bolton gets in there, screws it up so badly that the whole thing fell apart, and to this day, we can't now enforce this.
I don't know the history of that specifically. I'm sure that I'd rather not comment.
Okay.
I just don't know that particular story.
Okay, let's take a few phone calls and see where we are on this thing. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Nick in Pittsburgh in an automobile. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Never mind. On the comments that he did make, okay, I don't believe that a lot of Americans, or all Americans, or most Americans, however you want to parse it, feel that way about the United Nations. I think a lot of people just would give them the benefit of the doubt. It's a tough job and a tough position that they're in. And I think on part of your guest here today, like a lot of the conservative commentary, it all borders on manufactured consent and what they want people to believe and what they want people to think about organizations and different entities out there in the world right now today.
In other words, you're suggesting that what Evan is doing is just basically spinning an anti-UN thing in defense of...
It's always that way. It's the whole thing, you know, on the conservative side. Maybe on the Democratic side, too, you have it, too. I don't know. But nonetheless, it still strikes as that same thing. Every time I hear that thing, most people, all people, most, you know,
sure.
It's the first thing
some
I
people.
Think is that manufactured consent, you know?
Okay, so let me ask you a question. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name in Pittsburgh.
Nick. Yeah.
Do you think the United Nations does a good job? Do you think that they're living up to the reason that they were created? Do you think it's appropriate that literally half of their resolutions have been condemning this tiny democracy in Israel while there's virtually nothing about Rwanda?
But hang on just a second, Evan. This is not a referendum on the UN. We're talking about John Bolton here.
Okay,
and
so
I was just going to say
we were talking about the UN. The gentleman said, "Do we believe that that most Americans recognize that it is a corrupt organization that has done more to promote evil than it has to fulfill its agenda?"
No, I don't believe that. Not for a second. Think they've done what they have a position and they have a place and they do the best that they can do under the circumstances. And I don't think the U.S. or maybe a lot of other people have helped them out.
You mean stealing food from the Iraqi people in a corrupt deal with Saddam Hussein?
How do you know it's only been the United Nations?
Let's talk about the oil that's been stolen by Halliburton here. Yeah. Okay, you guys, I gotta tone it down here for a second. We gotta take a break. But Nick, thanks for the call, Evan. Thank you for your response so far. We're talking with Evan Sayet, evansayet.com, his website. Evan Sayet, promulgator of the conservative talking points for the day, our Behind Enemy Lines segment. I'm Tom Harbin. It's 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Evan Sayet, evansayet.com, his website. Evan, one of the authors of the conservative talking points, as it were, one of the representatives of the right. And my goal, Evan, my goal in having you on this program is that I know that anybody who's listening to this program has somebody in their life, a brother-in-law, a friend, a neighbor, somebody that they work with, who holds your political views, which are so very different from mine. And I think it's important that we learn how to talk with each other, and that perhaps, not even perhaps, that you and I should be modeling how people can have discussions about these things, and yet afterwards still be each other's brother-in-law, although you're not related to me at all in any way, and you know, but you get the point.
Yeah, but I think you're exactly right in doing it this way, because the way that we've maintained our friendship is we never see each other.
Yeah, there's that. So, but in any case, I think it's important to do that, and therefore I want to try as often as possible to take things to the next level, take them to the, you know, what's the bigger picture here? Are you suggesting, you started out by saying, I think we all want the UN not to be corrupt, blah, 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 but I thought the main conservative talking point was that we want to get the U.S. out of the U.N., we don't want to have anything to do with the U.N., we don't want to pay our dues to the U.N., to hell with the U.N.
Absolutely not. In fact, quite the opposite. When after 9/11, the anniversary of 9/11, the day before September 10th, 2002, George Bush went to the United Nations, addressed the United Nations, and treated them as if they could possibly be a force for good and importance. No, the goal is not America out of the UN or UN out of America, unless they continue to be a force for anti-Americanism, a force for corruption, a force for raping children in the Middle East and in Africa. You know, we'd love for the United Nations to serve its purpose and actually be a forum where people of goodwill get together and hash out differences.
And you think
but that's not what
make,
it is.
And you think the best way to make that happen is to send a guy to the UN who says things like this.
The point that I want to leave with you in this very brief presentation is where I started, is there is no United Nations. There is an international community that occasionally can be led by the only real power left in the world, and that's the United States, when it suits our interests and when we can get others to go along. The Secretariat building in New York has 38 stories. If you lost 10 stories today, it would make a bit of difference.
You think that's a good thing?
Oh, I think it's absolutely great. I mean, straightforward, blunt, and accurate. I have absolutely no problem with, instead of pussyfooting around things, that it's time for us to say, you know what? Raping children in Africa is not your job. Stop it.
You know,
stealing food from people's mouths in Iraq.
There is nobody in the United States who is in favor of raping children in Africa. Come on.
No, there's nobody who's in favor of it, but willing to look the other way because it's being done.
Nobody's looking the other way. It's being spoken out loudly against by people on both sides of the aisle. That is not a partisan issue.
Okay.
It is not a partisan issue.
Look, so the bottom line,
and trying to make it a partisan issue is denigrating both sides, Evan.
The bottom line is that we have a very big disagreement, and the people at home need to take the time to research and think it through. One side thinks that the United Nations is a force for good in this world, and the other side recognizes that on paper it's lovely, like communism. On paper it's lovely, but in reality it's a force for evil.
So you're saying that right now the United Nations is a force for evil?
Absolutely.
And the way to fix it is to do what? Other than, you know, speaking bluntly. What specifically would you do?
Okay, instead of paying for virtually everything as they get together in their corrupt ways and attack America and America's allies, America's friends, say to them, you know what? You don't straighten out your act. You don't get our money. Our taxpayer money is not going to pay for your corruption and anti-Americanism anymore.
So, in other words, this is like my saying to you, Evan. Evan, I'll talk to you, but only if you talk about exactly if you say exactly what I want to hear.
No, not even close. It would be I won't talk to you, Evan, anymore unless you stop calling people names and unless you stop calling my competitor and lying about me.
No, but see, as soon as there's an unless in there, you know, there's the and I'm not going to talk to you anymore, you know, or I'll only talk to you unless. Then the system starts to break down. You can't have a dialogue with those kind of caveats and conditions. You got to say, we're here, we're going to work this out. We're going to stay through this.
No, but you do have caveats and conditions. For example, you don't get into negotiations with people of bad will, because no matter what contract they sign, it's not going to be fulfilled. Of course you have caveats.
Okay, we'll continue this and your calls right after this break. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harbin.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends.
Stretch myself back into the vibe. I'm waking up to say I've tried instead of waking up to another TV guide.
27 minutes before the hour.
This kind of mindless creation of the United Nations as something different from what it's in the United States' interest to do
isn't going to sell here or anywhere else.
The ignoble, in my opinion, John Bolton. We're talking with Evan Sayet. Evan, EvanSayet.com is website. I don't want to call you our conservative punching bag here, Evan.
That's all right. I don't feel like I've been hit once. So.
Okay. Well, good. As long as you're thinking that, and I'm, you know, it's a, I get it that the United Nations has been dancing to the tune of the United States far more over the last 50 years or so than it's danced to the tune of anybody else in the world. The United Nations has been a strong friend and ally of the United States. The United Nations
has advanced
the interests of the United States in many, many ways, going all the way back to its formation in the 1950s.
But that is so easily debunked by how many times America has had to cast the lone no vote against some.
But the reality is that we can cast a lone no vote in the Security Council and shut down the entire UN. And
yeah,
we do.
And so can communist Russia, and so can communist China.
That's right,
and,
because it's a consensus system. The communist
China that you guys love with Walmart. And I do not believe that consensus is what makes truth. Truth is what good is what makes good, not the fact that you can get China and Russia to say yes to something. Truth isn't defined by getting passing a global test. It's by passing a test of decency and morality and rightness.
The reality, though, is that there is, your comment is almost internally contradictory. When they put together the Declaration of Independence, for example, they passed a global test. They said respect for decency requires us to list the reasons why we're separating from England. And then it puts out the list. Here's the list. Here's the statements.
It wasn't to pass a global test.
Sure it was. It was to say to the world, here's the reasons why we're doing this. And the United Nations is a forum for that.
Especially knowing that there were people in America who had reason to want to stay with Great Britain, to stay with England. And thus, they made it very clear what their purpose was in saying these truths are self-evident. We don't need China's permission to know what.
No, that was a different part of the. It was a different part of the Declaration of Independence, Evan.
The list of the grievances
that we had are not the truths that were self-evident. The truths that were self-evident.
Of course.
Yeah, you know that. Come on.
Yeah, of course. But my point being, the entire purpose in all of those documents they wrote, in Thomas Paine writing Common Sense, in all of the layout and the efforts to be clear about what we were doing and why we were doing it, wasn't to get France's permission, and it wasn't to get China's permission.
But it was.
To get Kofi Annan.
But it was.
To say we're good.
It was. It was to get the rest of the world on our side, and we succeeded in doing that, and we got France into the war, and if France hadn't participated in the Revolutionary War, we probably would have lost.
We got France into the war because they wanted to fight and defeat and weaken England, because they read our books and said, oh, that's right.
I'm telling you, Evan, if we had been thumbing our nose at the French, it may have come out very, very differently. The American Revolution, there might not be an America if we hadn't practiced diplomacy in writing the Declaration of Independence. Okay. And that's my concern. This guy is no diplomat. He doesn't understand diplomacy. Let's go to the phone lines. Kenny in Baltimore, Maryland on the line. Hey, Kenny, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Man, your guest just pisses me off every time you open his lips.
Well,
hey, I'm gonna clear your Africa deal up. You keep bringing up the whole thing about starving on Africa. And Africa is the richest continent in the freaking world. But everybody is robbing them of their natural resource, the gold, the diamond, and all the other resources they can get out of there. And then people depend on the table scraps to get back from people to feed them. Instead of letting them invest in their own natural resources and have their own stuff and give them back their own land that belongs to them rightfully, then they wouldn't be in this contradiction and we wouldn't have to spend money over there to feed the people.
Well, this has certainly been the history of Africa for the last, couple hundred years. Yeah, the colonial history of Africa.
The tribal warfares and the Mugabes and the Sudanese murdering other Sudanese have nothing whatsoever to do with the poverty over there.
You know what?
It must be that we went over with our equipment and mined the rocks that they couldn't find and then buy it from them.
So, Evan, just pause for a minute here.
Uh-huh.
Tell me then, is it because they're black, Evan?
Of course not. It's not because they're black.
Then what is it?
It's that cultures grow up in different ways, and unfortunately, like the Islamist culture that keeps itself down through tribal warfare and machismo and murder and corruption,
hang on just a second here, Kenny. And so, Evan, don't let's not filibuster each other here, okay? Mm-hmm. So, if it's the cultures grow up in different ways, can you acknowledge that the problems of Africa might have something to do with the fact that we've been messing with their culture for 300 years?
No, we'll just
leave it right there because we got it. Okay.
I, could it have something to do with it? Of course. But the point is that the reason for it? Is the description this gentleman just gave of that really the richest and the only reason they're not successful is because we've been stealing their resources? Of course not.
But that's the reality. I mean, you know, Spain became the richest country in the world by ripping off North and Central America and South America back in the 18th century. And then the rest of the European countries. Belgium became rich because of the wealth that they took out of Africa. You know, the French were doing it. The British were doing it. Everybody we're doing it right now with oil.
So conversely, then why?
Pat Robertson's doing it with diamonds.
So conversely, then why isn't Belgium the world's only superpower? Obviously, part of the reason has to be that we do something right. Maybe what we do right is we don't murder our tribal enemies, and we actually go into business with them,
and we find
a way to work together instead of the Sudanese massacring the Christians because they're Christians.
Actually, I would say that there was a time when Belgium was part of the ruling world empire, the European empire, and it's because they were stealing the resources of the planet. And there are a lot of folks in the world who are looking at the United States right now and saying, hey, wait a minute, 4% of the world's population, you're using 25% of the world's energy. What's wrong with this picture?
Well,
and they're looking at us saying
the
same thing. Kenny, thanks for the call. I appreciate your comments.
What's wrong with the picture, Tom? What's wrong with the picture is it only tells half the story. Because while we might use 25% of the Earth's resources, partly because when you're murdering your entire population, you're not making a lot of toaster ovens.
I'm sorry, Evan. I'm not going. You know, that's not making sense.
Which is going to be a more profitable group? Is it going to be America, where everybody, no matter their color, no matter their sex, no matter even their gender, has the opportunity to work and contribute, or the Sudan, where the Muslims are massacring the Christians?
I am absolutely as opposed to the Muslims massacring the Christians in the Sudan as you are, Evan.
But you won't admit that even in the slightest, that might be a tiny...
No, you won't admit that the reason that the situation in the Sudan is the way it is because Europeans have been meddling in that part of the world for 400 years, ripping people off for their resources.
Right. It has absolutely nothing to do with the fact
that... I didn't say absolutely.
...that massacre all infidels. Nothing at all.
No, I didn't say absolutely. Certainly, there is the problem there. But how did that come about? How did those conflicts come about? I would say that if we hadn't been messing in that... But let's not turn this into a forum on Africa. I want to bring it back to the United Nations. Derek in Woodbridge, Virginia on the line. Hey, Derek.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Evan.
Hey, Derek.
You say that the United States doesn't kill our tribal enemies, but I seem to remember us slaughtering a third of the population in East Timor with U.S. weapons.
And Henry Kissinger's complicity. Or, for that matter, if you want to talk about our tribal enemies, let's go back to the largest single item in George Washington's budget, which was labeled Indian Warfare.
Okay, so if you want to, and you know I disagree with the rewriting of history so that America, once again, the absolutely innocent, of course they were cannibals and misogynists and whatnot, but
what?
Absolutely terrific, wonderful
Wait
Indians.
A second. You're talking about the Native Americans?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Evan. They were not cannibals and misogynists.
Okay.
They really were not. I mean, you really ought to read a little bit of history.
Everybody except for Americans are absolutely perfect, and Americans are ultimately evil.
This attempt to totally mischaracterize somebody else's argument.
But the idea that you have to go back 250 years to find something that you can attack America for.
No, we're talking about 25 years ago here.
Today, even as we speak, the Sudanese are massacring the Christians.
The Clinton administration.
What was?
The slaughter in East Timor.
Okay. I mean, I don't remember my troops being there. I don't remember
all
being
these
there.
Iraqis.
I'm sorry?
Who was our best pal, Saddam Hussein? We gave him anthrax. We gave him botulism.
See,
we
once
gave
again,
him histoplasma.
This is an important point.
We gave Saddam E. coli.
Okay, this is an important
Hewlett
point.
Hewlett-Packard
because...
gave him Scud missile
okay,
program.
This is an important point because, once again, it requires only half the story to be told. And, of course, the part that is exculpatory for Americans is completely left out. You see, Ronald Reagan didn't wake up in the morning and say, I got nothing to do today. Where can I find some evil man? Ronald Reagan woke up in the morning and said, oh, my goodness, there's a fascist, mass-murdering terrorist regime in Iran that is trying to spread this terrorist, fascist regime throughout the Middle East.
And that terrorist, fascist regime was under the Shah that slaughtered all his political opponents, The Shah came to power.
Absolutely was a bad man.
Who was put into place by the United States CIA overthrowing a democratically elected leader.
Well,
I mean,
Evan. When you say democratically elected, you mean simply that he was able to get the most votes. Not that there was free press that allowed people, not that there wasn't intimidation, just that people walked to the polls.
Evan.
I mean,
come on, Evan.
You know what? Saddam Hussein.
Well, you can say the same thing about George W. Bush.
Okay, Saddam Hussein was democratically elected too.
Yeah, well,
no, he was
99% of the vote. Office by the United States.
Yeah, exactly. Saddam Hussein, exactly. Well said, Derek. Thank you for the call. Derek said, you know, Saddam Hussein was put into office by the United States, and he was.
That's just an outright lie.
No,
he came to power on his own, and when
we supported him because we wanted, and there's some rationality, I suppose, to this. We wanted a secular voice right there in the Middle East. And
there was a secular voice prior to Saddam Hussein, the person that Saddam Hussein took over the position from.
Okay, Tim in Indiana, Pennsylvania is on the line. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hi, guys. I want to go back to something that Evan said early on. When he first started to talk about the UN, he used the term evil. And what I find sort of common these days in these kinds of conversations is that the evil is always looked at as being something out there and something different from what we do, some culture that's different than ours, some religion that's different than ours, some form of government that's different than ours. And I'm struck by the idea that this conservative administration seems to want to think that evil is always over there and never here in our own backyard.
May I respond? You see,
Evan, hang on just a second. Let Tim finish his thought.
Okay.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that this sort of mindset that says that has an us and them framework that always sees evil as being them or those people over there or those people who are Muslims or those people who are Africans or those people who are whatever. It seems to be rampant. It's in the title of all the books these days. You conservatives use it fairly easily and quickly with a very broad brush about many things. I think that this last caller was really pointing out the fact that we have this tremendous propensity for evil ourselves. And part of what the UN's goal is to make sure that evil is not operating everywhere, including in our own backyards and in our own minds and in our own activities around the world.
Okay.
And we have quite a history of that.
May I respond? Yeah.
Well, before you do, Evan, let me just. I think that I can summarize what Tim said, perhaps. Well, in my own words, anyway. Mm-hmm. And that is that what you're suggesting, Evan, is that there's an us and there's a them out there. And that's the frame that the conservatives use with regard to the United Nations. It's us versus them. And what I'm suggesting and what Tim is suggesting is that there's a we, that we are part of a we, and it's all the humans in the world. And some of we are screwed up, and some of we are killers, and some of we are insane, and some of we are doing things wrong, and we have an obligation to us to help us clean up our act.
And your point of view would be,
it's a them. We need to kick them upside the head. We need to yell at them. We need to point them. And that's the fundamental cleavage. Sure, go for it.
And the concerns that we Republicans have is that, of course, we recognize that there's things that we do wrong, but our concern is that you guys, in order to protect the notion that there is no them, there is nothing that's bad, there is nothing that's wrong, simply side over.
Wait a second, you just mischaracterized what I said, Evan. I never said that there's nothing that's bad and that there's nothing wrong, and I never said that there is no, you know, you're saying that I said something or that Tim said something that neither one of us said.
Well, they did. The idea that nothing can be, in order to prove that nothing is evil or no...
Neither one of us are suggesting that.
That isn't what I said. You misunderstood me. You really misunderstood me. What I said is that evil is in the hearts of all men and that we all have a responsibility to make sure
have a responsibility to make sure that if there's a degree, if it's in all men's hearts, then there's no difference between Hitler and Mother Teresa. But we need to also say, you know what? Hitler's bad and Mother Teresa is good. And if you want to take that as I'm trying to divide or I'm seeing it's just them and it's Mother Teresa because she's a Christian and he was a socialist, you can go ahead and do that. But the reality is the Republicans have been extremely tolerant. But when it gets to the point where we are fighting an evil or a real threat, or when they fly planes into our buildings and they say they're doing it for Islam, and Islam is murdering people all over the world, maybe it's time for the Democrats to step back and say,
but you just did it again. You use the word Islam with a broad brush. You need to say exactly what you mean. If you're talking about very violent, radical fundamentalists from other religions, you need to be very clear about what you're saying.
But
when you use
radical.
The word Islam, you do exactly what George Bush did when he said, bring them on.
Okay, so could I do it with the Nazis? Could I say that we need to fight the Nazis and the Nazis are the bad guys?
We've already defeated the Nazis, Evan.
I'm sorry?
We've already defeated the Nazis. It was done by liberal Democrats.
I don't understand the point that we can't point out.
Not only did liberal Democrats defeat the Nazis, but we helped Germany write a constitution. We helped Germany write a constitution that included protections for labor, that included a national health care system, that included, a liberal democracy. It actually works.
I don't get your point. I just don't get the point of that.
Well, I'm saying
the point,
Hitler was defeated by the liberal Democrats.
Liberal Democrats back then were not what liberal Democrats are today. You didn't have liberal Democrats. So I call you guys modern liberals because it's a different.
You had Harry Truman suggesting national health care. You had Franklin Roosevelt put into place the Social Security Act that you guys are so opposed to. Thanks for the call.
We're so opposed to Social Security.
Yeah, well, according to the last study that I saw, George Bush out there trying to deconstruct it. But that's an argument for another day. We'll come back after this commercial break. Try and take a couple more calls. We'll try to do it a little more quickly. We'll just have a few minutes. Talking with Evan Sayet, EvanSayet.com, his website. I'm Tom Hartman. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back.
I stood on the rail till I saw that train just to see how my heart would react.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. Evan Sayet is with us, EvanSayet.com, his website. And Rama in Vermont is on the line. Hey, Rama, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Just two real quick points here somebody else can get on. One is, sending somebody from the Bush administration down to reform the UN, if that's indeed what needs to be done, which I don't argue with, is basically insane because you're trying to put forth the proposition that a totally corrupt federal administration is going to be interested in doing reforming, and I happen to know better from just being alive. And the second thing is, from what I can understand from what Mr. Sayed says, if I had depended on his rationales for my life, I would still be a mindless drunk, or I would be dead from liver cirrhosis right now. I quit drinking because I needed to do something from within myself to make a positive change, and then I've been able to do a hell of a lot more good in the world than I ever had a chance to
do. You mean it wasn't easier just to blame somebody else, Rama?
Well, it was easier.
That's what you guys are doing. You're blaming the Bush administration for corruption.
You're blaming us
for taking Africa's minerals. You're blaming us.
You're lying, Evan. Nobody
I'm
ever
lying.
Said
That's
that.
What, I'm doing.
What everybody
I'm lying.
Has put forward is the simple reality that in order to make positive change, one also needs to work on oneself. That's
absolutely.
An also
but
that's
working
not
on oneself doesn't mean writing
Evan,
about Abu Ghraib for 44 straight days on the front page of the New York Times while ignoring that
Evan,
90,
torture,
that 96%
torture is
of Iraqi children are now immunized.
Thing, and anybody
you know, working
that
on yourself also means recognizing your good instead of always
individual.
Tearing down.
Okay, both of you guys, I'm potting you both down for a second. And Evan, get control of yourself here. Rama, thank you for your call and for your comments. Evan, you still there?
I'm here, but I've always been in control.
Yeah, no, we can't do this if we're going to filibuster each other. I mean, we can interrupt each other.
But I got to get the talk. I mean, you guys go on and on, and then I say one sentence and you jump on
it. I understand. But, if it takes 44 days to get Abu Ghraib fixed, then that's what it takes.
Yeah, but
torture is a terrible thing.
Torture is a terrible thing, but the job of the newspaper is not to report the same story for 44 days and ignore all that's good about the other million servicemen who are there.
It is the job of the news. Well, first of all, news generally is not about all the wonderful things that are happening in the world. It's about the terrible things that are happening in the world.
Not and for 44 straight days because there were panties on people's heads.
If we are still paying for Abu Ghraib by our soldiers being killed by people in Iraq, then it's still an issue, and it should still be on the front page, in my opinion.
44 straight days?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And on that point, Evan, we will agree to disagree. It's EVANSAYET. Thanks for being with us, Evan. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom. You bet.
And thanks to all our callers who called in, and my apologies to those who couldn't make it through. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, broadcasting live on radio stations coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, Live 365's American FM, and WhiteRoseSociety.org, podcast at Apple iTunes. Welcome back to our program. It's 7 minutes past the hour. Bioneers, our Bioneer segment for the week. Bioneers are scientists and artists, gardeners and economists, activists and public servants, architects and ecologists, farmers and journalists, priests and shamans, policymakers and citizens. They're everyday people committed to preserving and supporting the future of life on Earth. They herald a dawning age of restoration founded in natural principles of kinship, interdependence, cooperation, reciprocity, and community. Bioneers.org is the website for Bioneers, and our Bioneer for today is Michael Schumann. Michael Schumann is an attorney and economist and vice president for enterprise development for the Training and Development Corporation of Bucksport, Maine. He's written, co-written, or edited 6 books, including most recently Going Local, Creating Self-Reliant Communities in the Global Age. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you.
I'm very pleased to have you here. Tell us what communities, why is it so important that communities focus on local sources of power, on local economies, on local sources of food and resource bases, as opposed to this highly centralized national and international focus and direction that certainly this country has been moving in progressively more and more over the last 50 years, and that is advocated so aggressively by the globalizers and the national, you know, the big oil, big power, all that kind of stuff.
Right. Well, there's probably two very big reasons why local ownership matters. The first is that when you don't have local ownership and you try to raise labor or environmental standards on a business, it moves. And if it is locally owned...
You mean it moves out of the area.
That's right. And if it is locally owned, it tends to adapt rather than flee. The second reason is that locally owned businesses spend more of their money locally. And so what economists call the multiplier effect, that is the fact that when I spend money at, say, a local filling station, the person who works there spends his money at a local theater and so forth. And the more times that that money circulates in the community, the faster it circulates without leakage, the more income, wealth, and jobs. And we know from a number of studies that have been done that the economic impact of a locally owned business is about 2 to 4 times what it is for a non-local business.
The positive economic impact. At the end of the evening, every night, with a Walmart or a McDonald's, somebody in Chicago with McDonald's or somebody in Bentonville, Arkansas with Walmart pushes a button and sucks out of the checking account, out of the bank account of the local store, all that cash, and the only money that comes back is the salaries and taxes and, you know, just basic expenses, but none of the profit comes back into the local community. I would say, though, that there's a third thing. I remember when I was, I'm old enough to say, when I was young, that there was a social pressure component that worked with local businesses. I mean, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, the vast majority of CEOs, of owners of companies, CEOs of companies, only made 30, 50, at the very most, broadly, at the very most, 50 times what their employees were making. And that's because there was social pressure. There was the, this idea of obscene, exploitation of workers.
Right.
And now with the managers making decisions in Bentonville and the workers being in Portland, Oregon, it's, they don't care about the local community's attitude or opinion about them.
I think that's absolutely true. And there are many different stakeholders around a company that can keep it in check and kind of push it to behave in a more responsible way. And you're right that the neighbors are one, the workers are another. If the workers are connected to the company and connected to the management, then there is some of that impact. If the owners live local again, you have all kinds of mixing with folks. If you see the environment that you're spoiling, then you take better care of that. So I think all of those things, the more you localize all of those factors, the more you can get them to pay attention to one another and reinforce one another.
Let's talk about locally produced power.
Electricity power.
Yeah, electricity, yep. Yeah. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that we have learned through several successive catastrophes in the utility system that the municipal utilities are the strongest entities there are. For example, when there were these cascading blackouts in the Northeast a couple of years back, it was the municipal utilities that were able to ride them out without losing power. And more recently, with Enron, we know that the municipal utilities in California were able to avoid the shenanigans of the price manipulations that Enron was able to effect on everyone else. And so we learned that local control of electricity is quite important in creating a strong, self-reliant, economically powerful locus of energy. And I think that there's a lot to be said for taking advantage of a bunch of technologies, everything from conservation to solar to geothermal, that can increasingly localize our energy and electricity system.
Let me just, by the way, mention that if any of our listeners want to, have a question for Michael Schuman, our phone number is 1-866-889-8894. We're talking with Michael Schuman, an attorney and economist, vice president for enterprise development for the Training and Development Corporation of Bucksport, Maine. Michael, is there a website where people can find out more about your work?
Yes, www.tdc-usa.org.
Okay. Now, what about the possibility of generating local power at the truly community level, where a city block or five city blocks might generate their own power, and having really, or even an apartment building or a house develop their own, generate their own power, and having a, completely off the grid, as it were?
Well, I think it's possible, and what one has to be mindful of here is that the more self-reliant you become, say if you have a generator in your house, and that is your electricity or energy system, if you don't have a connection to something else, if your system goes down, you lack the backup and the reliability. So building things out, not just at a block level, but really at the municipal level and even at the regional level, is probably valuable just to ensure some reliability of the energy sources if the technology goes down. Now, that said, there are many emerging, again, using a popular term with economists, economy of scale. There are many economies of scale that are at a very small level. So the idea of creating, a small rural town, creating a relative degree of self-reliance with wind machines is really coming into reality. The possibility of a bunch of businesses in Santa Fe becoming self-reliant on cogeneration from use of wood power in a district heating system, that's one project that I've been doing some research on recently, that is becoming more and more plausible. And as the price of oil and natural gas go up, all of these alternatives will become more and more cost effective.
Now, speaking of, you know, local businesses in Santa Fe, for example, you participated in a project in Maine of creating a local stock market?
We are in the process of designing this right now. And the idea is that, you know, most of us, including the listeners of your show who have pension funds, who hate Fortune 500 companies, nevertheless have nearly all of our wealth in Fortune 500 companies. Our 401ks, our 403bs, our IRAs, because we don't have any alternatives of where to put that money. And so what we're trying to do in Maine is develop ways that small businesses can create local stock issues so that only Maine residents can buy those stocks and make those stocks accessible by local pension funds and local employment funds and so forth. And to put this problem in perspective right now, by my calculation, something like 58% of all the goods and services that we consume these days come from local business. And yet, probably well over 90% of our investment dollars go into non-local business. And that's what economists would call a market misallocation.
So how does somebody create a local stock exchange?
How would someone create it? Well, the first stage is to actually make it easier and cheaper for businesses to create public offerings that can be circulated just within the state. The second stage.
Michael Schumann, how do you do that?
Well, that's where
it requires an infrastructure of some kind, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's where someone like me, an attorney, comes in and basically designs a template so you can do it yourself, go public, not for $50,000 with a law firm, but for $10,000 or $5,000 with somebody who is doing this on a regular basis.
So a local small business, a local restaurant, a local dry cleaner shop, a local, the corner garage, if you
yes.
wanted to start, or if you already own a small local business and you wanted to offer your stock for sale, which would bring an infusion of cash into your business, allow you to perhaps grow it or strengthen it or whatever, that you could do that on a purely local basis.
Absolutely. And one of the perversities of securities laws today is they make it very difficult for small businesses to do that.
Right. In fact, I was just going to ask, would then the local investors have the same protections against fraud and exploitation by the stock sellers that we have at the federal level?
Absolutely, because every state has its own concurrent structure for regulating securities, and they have hoops that you have to jump through for creating these direct public offerings. We're not trying to do an end run around all of those hoops and all those filings. We're just trying to make it easier for people. And, you know, I don't think it offers any protection for an investor to give them a phone book filled of fine print that no one reads anyway.
Right.
What they really want to know is, you know, is this a business that I'm familiar with? Can I look at the books? Can I taste the products that come out of it? And in my view, the local company offers an opportunity for a lot more checks and balances than you would have on a distant Enron-like company.
And people can find out more about doing this kind of thing at what website?
www.tdc-usa.org.
tdc-usa.org. Okay, Michael Schumann, you're doing great work. Real quickly, we have about a half a minute left. How does a community get rid of multinationals in their midst and encourage small local businesses?
Well, my view is, don't fight the multinationals. Create the local alternatives and look systematically at all of the things in your personal budget that are going to non-local entities. The biggest drain on our own expenditures is usually our housing. So if you have a mortgage, make sure it comes from a local bank, or if you're renting, make sure it comes from a local landlord, and that would instantly localize about a quarter of your spending.
Great. Michael Schumann, attorney and economist, vice president for enterprise development for the Training Development Corporation, our Bioneers segment for today, bioneers.org, their website as well. Michael, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Much appreciated. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Victoria Jones is with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. How's the belly of the beast there, Washington, D.C., doing?
Well, it's preempting belly. I mean,
it's getting hungry.
They're going. They're heading out of town at a rapid rate. In fact, most of them have already gone. President Bush heading off to Crawford, Texas for his brief five-week vacation tonight.
Now, this is his 50th vacation since he became president, and this one's running 5 weeks. But
it may not be five, but we were assured today that it won't all be vacation. He's going to be working.
Yeah, but this is a guy who doesn't think that employees should be able to bargain with their employers about vacation time. They should simply take whatever they are offered, period.
Well, I guess right? This is what he's offered then.
He's offered himself.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, there's different rules for the Bushes than for all the rest of us.
He also signed the CAFTA bill this morning. He said the measure would advance peace and prosperity throughout the region.
Yeah, CAFTA, otherwise known as the Take This Job and Shove It Act.
Oh, he says it's more than a trade bill.
Yeah, what is it?
I don't quite know, but he said it's more than he also says it's going to help strengthen democracies in Latin America.
Yes, if we build sweatshops in those countries, then the people will not be interested in revolution.
Such fun.
They'll be too busy working. Hey, it works here in the United States.
Good point.
It worked. This is the core of Dickensian economics. You get the people terrified and working, and they don't have the time to think about, you know, anything else. They just have to work all day long.
Well, speaking of which, John Bolton is beginning his work at the United Nations.
Work. Oh.
Yep, he's going up there. He's already presented his credentials. So he must have been on the Acela to get up there so fast yesterday.
Yeah.
Or maybe they drive him. Maybe he gets a special car now. I'm not quite sure.
I would guess they took him in an armored helicopter three guards. You know.
He had a brief meeting with Secretary General Kofi Annan. If it was private, I'd like to have been a fly on the wall. I don't know exactly what he was saying, but he's very enthusiastic. He's excited about it, and he thinks it's just going to be great.
This is going to be very interesting to watch, because one of two things is going to happen. Either John Bolton is going to get with the program. He's going to become a Republican, as it were, and the small r. That is, he's going to, you know, this Republic of Nations, the United Nations, he's going to become a participant. Or he's going to stand on the outside and throw stones. And what we've seen with the so-called conservative administrations of Ronald Reagan and George Bush Jr., is that they came in on the rhetoric of standing outside and throwing stones, and they basically wrecked the system. You know, we're $7 trillion in debt now as a result of Reagan and Bush Jr. Bush Sr., tried to slow that down. He actually increased taxes and tried to cut, he tried to make the system work to some extent. I don't want to congratulate him too much. He was vilified, but, you know, John Bolton is going to have to go one way or the other. Any sense of which way he's going to go?
No, there really isn't any. I mean, I've heard people saying, you know, that people can change when they get to this job, and they realize the different way that the UN works and that they can grow into the job. I don't get any sense yet of which way he's going to go. I mean, he had the full support of the President of the United States. We're told he had the full support of the Secretary of State. Don't know if that's true. So he has every reason to think that, you know, he can roll.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time. I mean, William Bennett had campaigned in the past on abolishing the Department of Education, and was it Reagan or Bush Sr. made him the head of the Education Department, and suddenly he changed his tune. A lot of, you know, Gingrich came into, you know, the Gingrich Revolution, so-called, brought in a lot of members of Congress who were committed to term limits and shrinking government, never voting for a tax increase, and blah de blah de blah, and a lot of them have become a little more mainstream. So, you know, I suppose we can hope that this guy will become rational. But one of our callers in the last hour, he said sending the Bush administration in to clean up any organization that they call as corrupt is a pretty ironic, pretty laughable concept. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah. Victoria Jones, thanks a lot for the insight and
the
input today here. Hey, Victoria, can you hold the line for just a second?
I'm sorry?
Can you hang on the line for just a minute?
Yes.
Thank you. I'd like to talk to you offline. It's 29 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Truth and common sense on the radio. For a change. We could use a lot of change in America. Not just spare change.
They're incredible. They're edible.
Well, you can eat them on the go from Kankakee to Kokomo.
The protein keeps you going.
Helps keep your muscles growing.
Hey! Praise will be quite audible.
Hey!
Surprisingly affordable.
Hey!
Go out and pick up plenty.
Hey!
You know the hens are ready. The incredible edible hay.
A message from America's Egg Farmers.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Cameras and crowds outside the NBA store in Midtown Manhattan are commonplace. But at 11 a.m. on Friday, July 22nd, the commotion at 5th Avenue and 52nd Street didn't center around a $20 million contract or a hot rookie hiring. About 40 people gathered for a press conference held by the National Labor Committee. The anti-sweatshop group announced a new report outlining workers' rights abuses in the Han Solo factory.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Daddy didn't like trouble, but if it came along, everyone that knew him knew which side that he'd be on.
Welcome back.
He never was a hero for this county's shining light, but you could always find him standing up for what he thought was right. He'd say, you've got to stand for something or you'll fall for anything. Be your own man, not a puppet on a string.
There you go. some of this bumper music is just absolutely great. I used to hate country music, and when I was a teenager, and one of my first jobs in radio was as a country western DJ, and I discovered that there's some really cool music out there. There's great rock and roll out there. There's some great blues. Anyhow, I'm blithering on about music, and there's things going on in the world. One of the most alarming is George W. Bush not only lied us into a war that has led to the death of 1,800 more or less Americans. We really don't know. I mean, it might be thousands more than that. And because there's some concern about whether people are counted as being Iraqi casualties if they die in Germany, if they die in transport, if they die when they get back to the United States. So we really don't know. But at least 1,800. The dismemberment, the severe wounding, physical wounding of tens of thousands, the psychological wounding of probably well over 100,000 Americans, and the death of at least 100,000 Iraqis, and the psychological wounding of millions of Iraqis. There's a generation of Iraqi children growing up right now who, when they come of age, are going to have a very different idea about the United States than their parents or grandparents did, who viewed the United States, many of them, as if at least a benevolent, and in many cases as a positive force in the world. So George W. Bush has not only lied us into a war for purely political purposes so that he could get what he calls political capital to advance his agenda, what he calls his agenda, ending Social Security, things like that. He not only did that, but now we discover, in addition to these deaths, we are bringing disease home from Iraq. And this is, I know, there's the large issue, the very large issue, you know, the elephant in the living room that very few people are talking about, of course, of the depleted uranium. And we're seeing now that virtually, I believe it's fully a third, you know, 33%, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but it's in that neighborhood anyway, about a third of all the veterans of the first Iraq war, the Gulf War, 1991, Bush Senior's War, are on some form of medical disability. Many of them, the majority of them, with some variation on Gulf War illness, which increasingly people are thinking is either related to the vaccines that they took or to the depleted uranium to which they were exposed, or both. And we again spread many more tons, hundreds of tons, thousands of tons, more depleted uranium on Iraq this time. But now on top of that, we've got a new bacteria to deal with. This a very serious infection that is now coming back from Iraq. And this it's called the I think it's acinetobacter. I don't know how to pronounce it. I will have to find somebody to tell us how to pronounce this, but acinetobacter or whatever it is. Military doctors from Forbes are fighting to contain an outbreak of a potentially deadly drug-resistant bacteria that apparently originated in Iraqi soil. This is by Matthew Herper. So far, at least 280 people, mostly soldiers returning from the battlefield, have been infected, a number of whom contracted the illness while in U.S. military hospitals. Acinetobacter baumannii, apparently, is what it is. And five extremely sick patients were in the same hospital as the injured soldiers have died after being infected with this bacteria. This is Arjun Srivansan, a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Public Health Service, medical epidemiologist at the CDC, says this is a very large outbreak, this infection. Doctors worry not only about soldiers who are already affected, but also those who are carrying Acinetobacter on their skin, even though they themselves are not infected. He said about 10% of the people, he's an infectious disease specialist, Lieutenant Commander Kyle Peterson at the National Naval Medical Hospital in Bethesda, said his hospital treated 396 patients who were wounded between May of 2003 and February 2005. 10% were infected with Acinetobacter, and 20% were found to have it on their skin, but were not infected. In other words, they were walking around being contagious. And apparently this can kind of like hang around for quite some time. So this is very concerning. Walter Reed Hospital is starting to freak out about this. Petrocelli says these are the sickest of the sick. Sometimes the infections become wound infections, sometimes respiratory infections, and sometimes bloodstream infections. Preventing the bacteria's spread, Forbes notes, has required doctors to take extreme care, putting all patients who are returning from the theater of war into isolation. Andrew Shore, a doctor who was working at Walter Reed, says if one of these pathogens, that once it gets into the population and chain of care, it can set up shop. Trying to contain the spread of this infection to other people is very difficult. So they tell a story of Marine Corporal Sean Locker. She was a suicide bomber, blew up a suicide bomb near his convoy, a car near his convoy. He got shrapnel in the nose, his right index finger, and his right eye, blinding him. His left lung collapsed. His left arm was badly damaged and had to be amputated. And then he was flown to Landstuhl, Germany, and then to Bethesda. And there, in his what was left of his arm, the doctors found this bacteria, Acinetobacter. And they say for Lochner, the prognosis was good, as 2 years of hard experience treating patients who had returned from war had taught doctors how to deal with the infection and to keep it from spreading to sicker patients. They had to use a combination of three intravenous antibiotics at the same time. Other patients have been less fortunate as they've suffered from infections of the bone, the bloodstream, or internal organs, which have complicated their care. He says it can cost up to $200,000 to treat somebody with this. This is absolutely, absolutely horrific. The result of war. You know, this is what happens when you have a war. I mean, terrible things happen. And George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and, you know, all these guys who had other priorities during the last opportunity to be in a war, Wolfowitz and Feith and Pearl and Bolton, all the guys who signed on to the Project for New American Century's letter, Bolton signed as well, all saying, hey, you know, go attack Iraq. Yeah, we need to win the war. Yeah. None of them served in combat. Most of them didn't serve in the military at all. And, in fact, the only one that I can think of in the bunch who actually did serve was George W. Bush. And he went AWOL and then deserted. And then, you know, finally came back and said, okay, can you just officially let me out 6 months early so I can go to Harvard? And the National Guard said, okay, sure, even though there's a war on, your daddy is you know, director of the CIA. We'll let you out. Wasn't that sweet? In the meantime, there are folks trying to figure out, what do the conservatives really want? You know, what are the cons really up to here? And this is the conservatives trying to figure out what the conservatives really want. They pulled together 36 distinguished public policy experts and scholars, conservatives, ranging from Nobel laureate Milton Friedman to Eagle Forum President Phyllis Schlafly to former House of Representatives Majority Leader Dick Armey. And they said, what are the top 10, quote, most harmful programs, end quote, that the federal government has? What are the 10 things that the federal government has that should be done away with? And so, number one on the list of the hit parade that the conservatives want to do away with, the Internal Revenue Code. The 16th Amendment says the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. In other words, we can charge taxes. But the conservatives say, no, don't think that's a good idea. Now, how are we going to have schools? They don't say. How are we going to have our fire departments, our police departments? They don't say. They just don't want us to have taxes. Maybe it's because, in conservative circles, you can afford to send your kids to a private school. You can afford to hire your own guards. You can afford to have fire systems built into your house. You know, I have lived and worked in third world countries where people, where there's basically two classes, two economic classes, the poor and the rich. And the rich live in gated communities with guards walking the perimeters, with machine guns, and the poor live in giant, huge, teeming slums, and there's very little in between. There's virtually nothing in between. If you don't want to have income taxes, then that's the kind of society you'll get. The number two thing that the conservatives think we should do away with, and again, these are proudly proclaiming this, the leading conservatives in the United States, the number two program they think we should eliminate, it was started in 1935, by Franklin Roosevelt, Social Security. And Social Security cost of $657.7 billion in taxes in 2004, paid out $501.6 billion in benefits. The Social Security Administration, one of the great social safety nets in America, one of the programs that has cut deaths from poverty among elderly people in the United States dramatically. I mean, we literally had people dying from starvation and from the cold or the heat, mostly the cold, in the 1930s, elderly people who now are alive because of Social Security. The conservatives think that this is a program that should be done away with. In fact, it was the second most highly scored program in terms of the most harmful programs that our government has. The third most harmful program our government has, according to conservatives, Medicare. Medicare was started in 1965 by that nasty Democrat Lyndon Johnson. Keep in mind, Social Security was started back in 1935 by that nasty Democrat Franklin Roosevelt. And the Internal Revenue Code, number one on the hit parade, was actually started in 1913 by a Republican, President Taft. But the Democratic President Woodrow Wilson was the first one who actually pushed through a progressive income tax, which has been giving cons fits ever since. In any case, back to Medicare, the number three program conservatives think we should do away with. The government imposes a 2.9% Medicare tax on all income earned by American workers. Medicare. Now, Medicare is a single-payer healthcare system. One of the really important things to note is that in the United States, we have two models of healthcare. We have three models of healthcare that we can all look at. The third model is the one that everybody's familiar with, which is privatized healthcare, where you go to an insurance company or you simply show up at the hospital or the doctor's office and you pay for it, and or if it's with the insurance company, you know, you're paying the insurance company, and they're making their money. For every $100 that goes through private health insurance companies, that goes through the private health system, about 20, well, it depends on the company and on the state, but between 15 and 30% sticks to the fingers of the health insurance companies or the HMOs. So that's, you know, the private system. And the private system is very expensive. We pay in the United States twice as much as any other country in the world for our health care. Twice as much as any other country in the world for our health care. That's the private system. That's the first. The second is single-payer health care. The example that we have in the United States of a single-payer health care system is Medicare. That's what it is. There is one central place where the bills are all paid. The government does not own the businesses to whom the money is being paid. In other words, the government doesn't own the hospitals. The doctors are not government employees. It's just that instead of having for-profit health insurance companies, you have a single payer. That is the federal government. And we all pay into that, and then the federal government pays the medical bills. And they do that at a cost of about 2%. Compare that with the 15 to 30% of the private health insurance companies. And you can see why countries that have single-payer health care systems, you know, like Germany, for example, have high-quality health care at a much lower cost than we do, and higher quality. The third kind of system that we have in the United States is socialized medicine, and the national example would be more like England. But the type of socialized medicine that we have in the United States, where the government not only pays the bills, but also owns the hospital and employs the doctors, is the Veterans Administration. The Veterans Administration is socialized medicine. And, you know, there are some who argue that the VA does not work as well as it could and or should, and that the only reason it's as well funded as it is, and wouldn't be as well funded if it covered everybody in the United States, the only reason it's well funded as it is because the military is a powerful constituency and nobody is willing to mess with the defense budget. But what we can see from these is that Medicare is a fabulously successful single-payer healthcare system. And I think, frankly, that we should simply say, okay, 100% of all Americans are now eligible for Medicare. End of discussion. And what's it going to cost us? Okay, it's going to cost us 9 or 10% that we're all going to have to pay as taxes. And what are we going to save from that? You're going to save the 15 or 20% that you're paying right now for health insurance, ultimately. And people say, well, I'm not paying that much. No, the costs are buried all over the place. Many of them are costs to society, but the overt costs are buried all over the place. Bottom line is that on an individual basis, except for the very wealthiest among us, on an individual basis and at a societal basis, we'll all be ahead. The only losers will be the health insurance companies who will be out of business. Anyhow, that's the third most vilified, most hated program by conservatives is Medicare. It's the Tom Hartman program, 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Broadcasting from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Xavier in Santa Cruz, California on the line. Hey, Xavier, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. Yeah, I wanted to talk about one of the things I find is that people in the United States and maybe Westerners in general have this tendency to think kind of dualistically. You know, if you're not with us, you're against us. And one of the things I find is that we get into arguments about capitalism and socialism. And I find that Marx had some good ideas and Adam Smith had some good ideas. But what happens is they get co-opted by people in power. And you were talking a bit earlier about abolishing the IRS.
Right.
And one of my ideas is that we do a little bit of political Aikido or jiu-jitsu on them. And the thing we really need to be focusing on is voting machines and being able to take things back. And we basically, in some ways, just give them what they want. And I think, like, if we were to abolish the IRS, we'd soon realize that we don't want to pay for war, and we don't want to pay for certain things, but we do want schools, and there's certain things we want. and it's kind of a death and rebirth thing. It has to die in order to be rebuilt.
Yeah, it may well be, and everything would happen locally. But in the meantime, the trauma would be so severe in this country.
Yeah.
I mean, it would just be.
It may very well be trauma, anyways, and it's a choice between slow trauma or fast trauma.
Yeah,
that's my point.
Well, yeah, and a good point, Xavier. Thanks for calling, and thanks for making that. I appreciate it. And in fact, what has happened now, and this is the thing that nobody wants to talk about, is that what has happened now is that by borrowing almost $2 trillion from the Social Security Trust Fund, a trust fund that only came into existence in 1982, Reagan brought this thing into existence with the largest tax increase in the history of the United States, doubling the Social Security tax on working people. So that working people starting in 82 through 2014 could actually pay for their own retirement, whereas all previous generations' retirements have been paid for by people then working. So the boomers, the baby boomer generation, will be the only generation that actually pays for its own retirement and pays for the current generation that's retiring while they're working. And Ronald Reagan started borrowing that money, and Bush Sr. was borrowing that money, Clinton borrowed some of that money, and Bush Jr. has borrowed a whole pile of that money, and that money has to be repaid. And the only way it can be repaid out of the general fund is to increase taxes. And it's going to be a dramatic tax increase that's coming down the road. Or Social Security is going to have to say, you know, we got a problem here. And the cons are not owning up to the fact that this is a train wreck that Ronald Reagan created by borrowing from Social Security so that he could fund huge tax cuts for the wealthy. And the George Bush has made the situation even worse. That's why the whole song and dance about privatization and everything else. I'm Tom Hartman, where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Mrs. Jordan Fogel confronted a surprise when a house was built for her and her husband, and turned out to be not quite what they expected. Mrs. Fogel, a Republican homemaker in Texas. Mrs. Jordan Fogel, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you, Tom. You keep saying take back America in Texas. We can't even take back our own homes.
Yeah, well, it looks like it. First of all, tell our listeners what happened when you bought this house.
Well, first night that we were in the house, my husband got in the garden tub on the third floor, and when he pulled the plug on the garden tub, 100 gallons of water came down through the dining room ceiling, flooded the dining room living room, went through that floor, and then flooded the garage. And at first we thought it was just, a fluke. They'd forgotten to connect the drains or whatever. And then we found out it was just previews of coming attractions.
For example?
Oh, well, the windows started leaking, the hardwood started buckling, the shower fell out, the outside stucco cracked, water started running out of the outside of the house. The yard flooded. I mean, it just didn't end. And then mold started growing up out of the carpet and out of the walls and in the pantry. And it was Stachybotrys and Aspergillium and Geranium. So I found the weapons of mass destruction right there in my own home.
Yeah, these are actually very toxic forms of mold. So you then decided that you were going to do something about this, right?
Well, I didn't know that I lived in a communist state. And I thought that I had $3,400 a year in homeowners insurance. I had Big Brother government to protect me and my rights in Texas as a homeowner. And that became a realization that was destroyed. I mean, I couldn't believe what I ran into, because here in Texas is an ADR state. That means you no longer have the Seventh Amendment rights. And
what is ADR?
ADR is Alternative Dispute Resolution State.
Okay.
And what they tell you is so convoluted, and they use so many acronyms, most people don't know what to do. What they tell you is, well, you live in an ADR state, So you have to go to TRCC for RCLA and SIRP, and you no longer have the DTPA, so you end up in AAA, the American
now,
Arbitration Association.
Right. Now, just so people know what you're talking about, the Seventh Amendment says, and it's just it's one sentence long, it says, in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. In other words, you have the right to sue somebody if you've been taken advantage of. If it's worth more than $20, that's what the Constitution says.
Well, we don't have any Seventh Amendment rights here anymore, and it's sweeping the whole country. I have subsequently found out. And not only that, to make it more egregious, they're trying to get by and shut up clauses in, so you can't even notify the Better Business Bureau. You can't even complain to your neighbor, or you're going to get sued.
Now, it turns out, it appears to me, that the group behind this trend that has that started in Texas and is going nationwide is, among others, a fellow by the name of Bob Perry, a multimillionaire home builder who funded the Swift Vote Veterans for Truth campaign in the 2004 election. Is that correct?
That's correct. And not only did he do that, he bought the... Well, Representative Garnett Coleman said, only in Texas can you buy your own agency and then regulate yourself. And he bought the Texas Residential Construction Commission. So before you can do anything here, if you have a problem with a home, you have to go through this commission. And Bob Perry's attorney helped write these laws, and he's one of the commissioners.
So how do you buy a commission in Texas?
You just donate 8.4, I think, million dollars to the campaigns, and then you
was this when George W. Bush was president or governor?
I think it started when he was governor. I'm not actually sure. I know the major laws went into effect in September 1st of 2003. But I mean,
so this is
imagine what stress and foreclosure and bankruptcy will do to people that are sitting in their homes thinking, hey, I'm making my payments on time, I'm paying my taxes,
yeah.
I've got a lovely brand new home, and they don't realize they're the face of the new homeless.
And this brought to you by a Republican administration that talks about, you know, the rights of the average person and small government and all this kind of stuff, seems to be a little inconsistency here, Mrs. Fogel.
Well, you know, you said in your intro that I was a Republican. That is true, but that is in the past tense.
Okay. You were a Republican.
I was a very conservative Republican. And when I got involved in this and started all this thing started happening 3 years ago, and I started going to Austin and talking to my legislators and my senators and getting patted on the head and sent back to Houston and going to the city council and speaking and going to the permit departments and get patted on the head, I found out that I don't trust anybody anymore.
Yeah.
And, I mean, anything that I do, I'm going to investigate.
So what is the solution? First of all, I guess there's a warning here that to coming to the state near you, and how many states? You said 29 states now have followed Texas's lead in passing these kinds of laws?
Well, I know 48 of the states, if I'm not mistaken, have the binding arbitration clauses in their contracts.
If you buy a house, you don't have the right to sue.
That's right. I was in Alabama a few weeks ago, and I asked one of my friends to let me see one of the real estate contracts there. You can't even sue the realtor in Alabama. You see, you could sue an inspector if he didn't do a good inspection, or the realtor in Alabama. You can't even do that.
Right. So what's the solution to this, Mrs. Fogel?
The solution, as I see it, is we have got to make enough noise that they see that tort reform has caused this binding arbitration contract to be in all our real estate contracts, and we're collateral damage is what we are of tort reform.
Well, tort reform is a phrase that the Republicans love to wave around and say, this is... You know, they're trying to solve the problem of lawsuit abuse. They, for example, John Edwards, they constantly refer to John Edwards as a trial lawyer. I would refer to him as a defender of the public lawyer. He's somebody who's standing up for people who've been harmed by big corporations. I mean, that's, you know, is that a bad thing?
Well, Tom, when I heard the rhetoric for tort reform, it did not sound that bad to me. We were going to have these astronomical lawsuits that were given to people done away with, and people weren't going to be able to sue for trivial things. I never dreamed that it was going to just sweepingly make the middle class inconsequential.
Yeah, yeah. And
I found out now it's not just the middle class. I mean, I'm not alone here. We've got 1.7 million houses with $300,000 worth of damage. I've got whole subdivisions built on lakes that are, their foundations are cracking. I mean, people are calling me every day, and they say, what do we do? And I say, there's nothing you can do. Go fix your own house. Pay for it. Whatever you do, don't go to AAA arbitration, which is the American Arbitration Association, because that's going to cost you a minimum of $50,000 to $100,000, and you're not going to win.
Wow. So what can you do? Mrs. Jordan Fogel, we're speaking with a former Republican grandmother in Texas whose home has been... it wasn't what she thought it was when you bought this house. What have you and your husband been able to do?
Well, I don't know that we've actually accomplished anything, but we've made a lot of noise.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're begging people to do is harp on your city people, your council people, your city council, your permit departments, and they'll send you to your state, and then you go to your state, you write. Well, I say write, I don't know. And then you go, I've even gone, let's see, I've got all this stuff into Sheila Jackson Lee yesterday, and I'm hoping and praying.
You're a member of Congress.
Yes, mm-hmm. That is my representative there. And what is amazing to me is with the new technology and the Internet, you can email, like when this started, I emailed George Bush 48 times.
Mm-hmm.
I faxed him at least that many times and wrote personal letters. Now, they go into some deep vortex somewhere.
Yes.
Because nobody returns anything. You get an automated response, and you get it from your senators, there's no personal contact.
Yeah. Now, it is possible to call your senator or your member of Congress. You won't speak with them in all probability, but you can speak to their staffers, and it's a toll-free number. It's the toll-free number.
I've been there. I went to their offices and went in and spoke with them.
Uh-huh.
And
they couldn't do anything for you. They said,
well,
tort reform has solved all our problems. You can't sue.
You can't sue.
Wow.
I mean, it is so sad. I know when I went to Austin, I went to see my representative here, Ms. Wong, told her all about what was happening here in Houston and that they had been thrown out of the Better Business Bureau. They were getting money from affordable housing.
This is your home builder.
Yeah. That they had about 30 companies that I had found already and that they just shuck and jive between them. So even if you go to arbitration, sometimes you can't get there because whatever company you say built your house, they just say it didn't.
Wow.
I mean, the Better Business Bureau, that's supposed to be your consumer protection, and I heard, oh, they won't help you. Well, I filed with the Better Business Bureau, and some advertising or some PR came out about the cases here in Houston, and one of the people called me, and they said, why didn't you file with the Better Business Bureau? I said, I did. You turned my claim down. And they said, and why did we say we did? I said, because you said it was another company that built my house, and it wasn't.
Yeah.
So they started investigating and found out what I was telling them was true and that they had been turning down claims for years for this builder.
Wow.
So they threw him out of the Better Business Bureau and used him as the poster child for bad building on their bulletin.
Yeah, but still, that, you know, they've got a bunch of victims out there who can't get anything back. Mrs. Jordan Fogel, we only have about a minute left. Are there any organizations nationwide that people can turn to? Are there any websites? Is there any phone number for who are working on this, who have taken this up as an issue, as a crusade to undo tort reform?
So HOBB.org was the only grassroots organization that I was aware of.
And what is HOBB?
That is Homeowners Organization for Better Building, and then there's the Nancy Seats with HADD. That's Home Builders Against Defective Dwelling. But unfortunately, these are people that have no funding. They have no help. It's just sad that there's not an agency or anything that I have found in the United States of America that will protect the homeowner.
Yeah. And given the fact that the vast majority of the middle class's savings are in their home.
Exactly.
This is the asset base of the middle class in America, and it's being ripped off and ripped out from underneath us by these kinds of practices. And then to find that this whole Republican thing of tort reform that they've been pushing so aggressively for the last 20 years, and very successfully at the state level now, means that those same middle class homeowners are stuck. And if, you know, God forbid it should get so bad you have to declare bankruptcy. Now, the Republicans just pushed this bankruptcy bill through that you can't declare bankruptcy.
Oh, it's going to kill us. I mean, you have to the new bankruptcy laws go into effect October the 1st. And, I mean, we're sitting here. We've already gone into foreclosure. Nobody would even bid on our house. It was in such a bad shape. But another thing that's so bad, Tom, is if these houses go into foreclosure and they have stachybotrys mold, they can still dump them on somebody else with no disclosure.
Oh, my goodness.
So they're moving into poison, and they don't even know it.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we can get something done about that. I mean, we'll start talking about it. And H-O-B-B. I'm sorry.
.org.
Okay. Mrs. Jordan Fogle in Texas. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for calling.
I do appreciate it. Good talking with you. It's 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends.
I ain't lived forever, but I've lived enough. And I've learned to be gentle, and I've learned to be tough. I've found only two things that last till the end. One is your heroes, the other's your friends.
One of my heroes is Harry Truman. He proposed in 1945 national health insurance for all Americans. He said, by preventing illness, by assuring access to needed community and personal health services, and by protecting our people against the loss caused by sickness, we shall strengthen our national health, our national defense, and our productivity. Harry Truman, 1945, the anniversary of Medicare and Medicaid. Was just over the last weekend, July 30th. It was signed into law in 1965. Lyndon Johnson proposed Medicare and Medicaid, and the first recipient of a Medicare card in the United States back in 1965 was former President Harry Truman. Medicaid and Medicare, we were talking about earlier, and I believe in the last hour, the difference between a socialized medicine system, a single-payer system, and a private system. We have the privatized system in the United States. Medicare and Medicaid are single-payer systems, and the Veterans Administration is a socialized medicine system. And we have, you know, the vast majority of our medical care is provided in the United States by privatized medical care. And it's costing us a fortune. As the World Health Organization's Dr. Christopher Murray told Holly Sklar for a piece that she wrote called Time for Healthcare for All on Medicare's 40th anniversary. Knight Ritter published this or distributed this. As he pointed out, we have a disaster going on in the United States. He said, basically, you die earlier and spend more time disabled if you're an American rather than a member of most other advanced countries. People say, well, we're living longer, we're living healthier. We lag in lifespan, life expectancy. We are number 29. Number 29 in life expectancy. We're 3 years behind Canada, 6 years behind Japan. But we are number one in one area. We are number one in the amount of money that we spend on health care. Yes, number one on the money, the amount of money we spend, even though we're number 29 in life expectancy. We have fewer doctors, fewer hospital beds, fewer MRI machines, fewer CAT scanners, fewer nurses than the average country in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. This is 30 OECD countries, 30 countries that are like basically the industrialized countries of the world. The average OECD country, spends 8.6% of their gross domestic product on health care for their people. We spend 15%. We're spending almost twice as much as the average OECD country all across the world. And what are we getting for it? Number 29. Fewer physicians, fewer doctors, fewer nurses. People can make appointments with doctors more rapidly in Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, and New Zealand than they can in the United States. And they cover 100% of their citizens. And we have 40 million people who have no insurance. As Holly Sklar points out, as the Institute of Medicine documents, uninsured Americans get about half the medical care of those with insurance. They receive too little care too late, get sicker, and die sooner. One out of three Americans below age 65, 8.85 million people, lack private or public health insurance for all or part of 2003-2004. Millions more are underinsured, and the average family is paying a premium this year of $14,545, double what it was in 2001 when George Bush came into office. 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
One, two, three, four.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and participate in interactive conversation with real people in real time. Walt in Crescent City, California on the line. Hey, Walt, thanks for calling. What's up?
Tom, I think one of the reasons people aren't complaining more about the conditions in the United States is the fact that they don't know what's going on elsewhere.
Yeah, for sure.
I have a cousin that I interact with on email. He lives in Australia, was born and raised there. He says that in Australia you have free medical care, you have supported college education, you have no law. Australia has no budget deficit; they have a big surplus. I mean, and they part of the reason is they aren't investing billions in war machine.
Yeah, that's a big part of the reason. Although I'd say the larger part of the reason is that they've had a government that has been fiscally sane.
Right.
I mean, we went fiscally insane the second year of the Reagan administration when Ronald Reagan bought into this whole Lafler curve thing and supply side trickle on economics, and we've been nuts ever since. We had a little moment of sanity there toward the end of the Clinton administration economically, at least domestically. And Clinton went nuts even, you know, with international trade policies. But, you know, it's, yeah.
And now I think we want to name the Statue of Liberty after Ronald Reagan.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Oh, my. Well,
thanks
for the
Tom.
Call. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Good to hear from you. Boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Please say it ain't true. Here we have, yeah, I mean, this is, I remember, you know, Thomas Jefferson, I mean, I don't remember Thomas Jefferson, but I remember reading his letter, coming across it, in which he said, in reading his collected writings, in which he said that he hopes that he shall never see his country degenerate to the point where our youth would be willing to sell themselves to be shot at for a sixpence. Well, this from the American Progress, the Think Progress blog. I believe it's a clip from the New York Times. I could be wrong. It's the headline, "On Furthest U.S. Shores, Iraq is a Way to a Dream." From Pago Pago in American Samoa to Yap in Micronesia, 4,000 miles to the west, Army recruiters are scouring the Pacific, looking for high school graduates to enlist at a time when the Iraq War is turning off many candidates in the United States. You get this? We can't hire enough people in the United States. Now, people in these countries are technically in the United States. It's a U.S. protectorate. These are the islands that we seized during World War II, in most cases. Guam, the Northern Marianas, American Samoa, the Marshalls, Micronesia. In the Marshalls and in Micronesia, the average annual income is $2,000 a year. This is, you keep in mind, this is where, when Tom DeLay went out there to Saipan, right? One of these islands. When Tom DeLay went out there with his good buddies, the lobbyists and whatnot, he went out there to lobby for the minimum wage, the American minimum wage of $5.25 an hour, not being applied in those countries. He was successful, by the way. So that the sweatshops could continue to operate and pay people $2, $3, $4 an hour. And he talked about what a paradise it was and all that kind of thing. And really, there's only two businesses in these, on a lot of these islands. The sex trade and the sweatshops. I guess that's a paradise to Tom DeLay. In any case, DeLay is the guy, you know, he brings you this, and now, well, there's a third thing that these islands, these countries have to offer to the United States. Cheap labor, not just domestic, not just in their home backyard, you know, where we can set up a factory and sew labels on that say made in the USA, even though it's made by somebody earning $2 an hour, because it's made in a USA protectorate island. But now these people from these islands are also, you know, you can join the U.S. military. You don't have to be an American citizen to join the U.S. Army. In fact, there are a lot of people who are not American citizens who are joining the U.S. Army simply as a way of more quickly getting U.S. citizenship. And the U.S. Army pays pretty good if you're coming from a country where the average income is $2,000 a year. So the article notes, the Army has found fertile ground in the poverty pockets of the Pacific. The isles that bind, is this not mind-boggling? You just think, you know, is this what we have come to? The tropical Northern Mariana Islands. Three-quarters of the way from Hawaii to the Philippines, this is from the Center for American Progress, with a population of just over 80,000 U.S. territories acquired after World War II. They make Tommy Hilfiger there, they make Gap there, they make Calvin Klein, Liz Claiborne, The Limited, JCPenney, and, of course, Walmart. The workers, they make about half the U.S. minimum hourly wage. And they're forced to live behind barbed wire and squalid shacks, minus plumbing, work 12 hours a day, often 7 days a week, without any of the legal protections U.S. workers are guaranteed. And, notes the Center for American Progress, if Tom DeLay and Jack Abramoff and George W. Bush get their way, that's exactly how things will stay. And it looks like they're getting their way. See, whether it's the American middle class or whether it's workers in Micronesia. The biggest supporter of sweatshops on Capitol Hill, that would be Tom DeLay. As the Center for American Progress notes, in the 1990s, the Clinton administration, with bipartisan support, they had Republicans on board with this thing as well as Democrats, they tried to crack down on worker abuse in the Marianas. Tom DeLay, well, to quote the Los Angeles Times, DeLay helped lead the fight beginning in 1997 to keep Congress from enacting reforms opposed by Abramoff and his clients that would have required garment manufacturers to pay their workers the higher federal minimum wage. End quote. In June of 97, then Tom DeLay, who was majority whip at the time, and majority leader Dick Armey, also promised to block any legislation to increase federal regulation on garment workers. A year later, 1988, he helped kill a congressional fact-finding trip that was being planned to investigate sweatshop conditions on the islands. 3 years later, he refused to allow a vote on a bill that would have prevented these companies manufacturing things in these islands with the sweatshop labor to put Made in USA labels on them. This was a bill, by the way, that was co-sponsored by 234 members of the House of Representatives. That's more than a majority. That's a bill that would have passed. Tom DeLay would not allow it to come to the floor for a vote. In Newsweek, Marie Coco writes that of all the qualified candidates for the worst thing Tom DeLay has ever done, one stands out for its squalor. That's his efforts on Saipan. This grasp at moral bankruptcy, as Mark Shields calls it. Tom DeLay said that the islands are the perfect petri dish of capitalism. It's like my Galapagos Island, he said. And with the ABC cameras rolling, Tom DeLay toasted the sweatshop owners and their supportive Saipan officials as a shining light, he said. who represented, and I quote, "everything that is good about what we are trying to do in America and leading the world in the free market system," end quote. Right. Keep people in barbed wire cages 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Make them work 12 hours a day. Pay them $2 an hour. And that is, quote, "everything that is good about what we are trying to do in America," end quote, Tom DeLay, toasting the sweatshop owners in the Marianas Islands, in Saipan. Well, he's right. I mean, that is what they are trying to do in America. This is the conservative agenda. They will be, you know, they won't be happy until there's no more Social Security, there's no more Medicare, there's no more Medicaid, there is no progressive income tax, there's only a flat tax. I mean, they imposed it on Iraq. Didn't it produce wonderful results? Aren't the people there happy? We rewrote their constitution to be a conservative constitution. Let corporations do anything they want. Ban labor unions. Flat income tax. Now compare that with the liberal constitutions that the liberal Democrats, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, imposed on Japan and Germany, or helped them write, as however you want to characterize it, where we helped them write into their constitutions the ideals that were held by the President of the United States at that time, even though he couldn't get it done in this country, in Japan and in Germany. You have the right to be a member of a labor union. Pretty much wherever you work, and most people take advantage of that right, you have the right to free health care. No matter whether you're working or not, no matter where you work, no matter who you are, no matter what your income is, you have the right to free public education all the way up through and including in Germany and Japan, in varying degrees in different places, but in varying degrees, free college or highly subsidized, very inexpensive college. Now, which country would you rather live in? The conservative Iraq with the conservative, the neocon constitution that we imposed on them, or in Germany or Japan? I mean, the three countries, we beat the military in all three of them. Yeah, Tom DeLay, he's right when he says that Saipan represents everything that is good about what we are trying to do in America, we being Tom DeLay and George W. Bush. When the last American worker is behind barbed wire, when the last American worker is working 12 hours a day, when the last American worker is so terrified of losing their job that they won't even speak up in their own defense, much less participate politically, then they will have accomplished everything that they're trying to do in America. As Senator Frank Murkowski told Mark Shields, "the last time we heard a justification that economic advances would be jeopardized if workers were treated properly was shortly before Appomattox." Right. Frank Murkowski, Republican from Arkansas. As if the Marianas didn't have to be bad enough, they proved to be a veritable treasure chest for Jack Abramoff, who was an advisor to the island's governor. For example, Abramoff would say the island government needed his services because it was the only American territory without a non-voting delegate in Congress. Except, as documents revealed by the New York Times show, he worked hard to kill a bill in Congress that would have given the islands a delegate. All right. Okay. So the islands want to have representation in the United States Congress because, after all, we own them, we run them, even though their citizens don't have rights. They're not American citizens. They have the right to join our army and go to Iraq. They have the right to work and produce clothing for the Gap and Hilfiger and Walmart. So they say, you know, we'd like to have, you know, sort of like the District of Columbia, we'd like to have a member, a delegate somebody who can speak for us, at least, even if they can't vote in the United States Congress. Jack Abramoff lobbies to kill that successfully and then goes to them and says, you can't have a member of Congress. I'm sorry, the Congress won't allow it, but I'll represent you. Now, this, by the way, is something that brings George Bush in. As the Center for American Progress notes, ties between Abramoff, President Bush, and Saipan go back as far as 1997, when Abramoff charged the Marianas for getting then-Texas Governor George W. Bush to write a letter expressing support for the Pacific Territory school choice proposal. Ah, yes. Let's privatize education, too. It works so well with health care. And it worked so beautifully with the power industry when Enron bought up all that generating capacity. Look at what they did to California. They were even able to flip a Democratic governor out of there by bringing down the power grid. Burn, baby, burn, remember? Privatization, you know, just has worked so very, very, very well.
Burn, baby, burn. That's a beautiful thing.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, well, I'm not even gonna play it. Well, if I gotta beep it, I'm not gonna play it. Anyhow, yes, there we go. And basking in the glow of corruption. I mean, this George W. Bush, Jack Abramoff, Tom DeLay, doing in Saipan successfully what they're trying to do in the United States, and they're actually doing that rather successfully, wiping out the middle class. Abramoff wrote to island officials in January of 2001 talking about the new administration, the Bush administration. He says, our standing with the new Bush administration promises to be solid as several friends of the Marianas will soon be taking high-ranking positions in the administration. He was right. Two members of his lobbying team got positions in the Bush White House, Assistant Secretary of Labor and Head of Federal Procurement Policy in the Office of Management and Budget. In the president's first 10 months, George W. Bush's first 10 months in office, Abramoff and his lobbying team logged nearly 200 contacts with the new administration. They pressed for friendly hires and lax labor laws with officials as high up as Attorney General John Ashcroft and policy advisors in Vice President Dick Cheney's office, and apparently worked. The islands, quote, fended off proposals in 2001 to extend the U.S. minimum wage to island workers and gained at least 2 million more in federal aid from the administration, end quote. By mid-2003, Abramoff had raised at least $100,000 for George Bush's re-election campaign, becoming one of George Bush's famed pioneers. You got to get it, what these guys are about. It's the destruction of an economic middle class that might be politically active. They cannot tolerate that. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In a building of gold with riches untold lived the families in which the country was founded. And the merchants of Star with their vain velvet smiles were there, for they also were hounded. And the soft middle class crowded into the last, for the building was fully surrounded. And the noise outside was the ringing of revolution.
And welcome back, my friends. 4 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Basking in the glow of corruption. We're talking about Tom DeLay, the Mariana Islands, the George W. Bush, the conservative agenda, what they want America to be like. And why is this relevant today? Because this is the area that is not only providing us with sweatshop labor, that is not only providing, is not only feeding the sex trade that when Grover Norquist and all these other guys, you know, send their delegations over to the Marianas to check out, they have available to them. It is also providing to us soldiers for our army. The new place where our army, where the United States Army and the Marine Corps and the can recruit soldiers, the Mariana Islands. Tom DeLay calling this a perfect petri dish of capitalism. Well, 96, 97, 98, as the petri dish started getting, contaminated, as it were, or growing, shall we say, Abramoff's team arranged many trips to the Marianas, notes the Center for American Progress, for conservative editorial writers and members of research groups like the Heritage Foundation, Grover Norquist's Americans for Tax Reform, the Institute for Justice. Abramoff also flew dozens of lawmakers and their aides for luxurious vacations to the Balmy Islands, including one 1997-98 New York trip for Tom DeLay and his wife. On that trip, Tom DeLay offered Jack Abramoff this now infamous toast. And I quote, "When one of my closest and dearest friends, Jack Abramoff, your most able representative in Washington, D.C., invited me to see the islands, I wanted to see firsthand the free market success and the progress and reform you have made." Yeah, just like the cons did. I mean, they've made great progress there in the Marianas. They made great progress in Iraq. It's like everything the conservatives touch just turns to success. It just becomes golden. And everything those lousy liberal Democrats touch, you know, like the Japanese Constitution, the German Constitution, just doesn't work. I'm sorry. Oh, wait a minute. I'm living in an alternate universe. Sorry. Oh, my. We must wake up America, my friends. You've got to pass the word along to others. So on that, I say, tag, you're it. Pass it along. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.